Well, we've just read Hosea chapter 1, but I've read chapter 1 as a by way of introduction, because this evening I want to look at an overview of the book, the prophecy of Hosea, and also to look at its background. The book of Hosea is not an easy book. In fact, it's quite a bit of a maze of warnings, sermons, poems, laments. It alludes to other biblical texts and other biblical incidents. The topics keep on changing, sometimes seemingly at random. So it's not an easy book. It's not easy also in the sense that it's not a comfortable book to read. One commentary says, it does comfort the afflicted. It does comfort the afflicted, but it also afflicts the comfortable. It gives a startling presentation of sin, but it also is stubborn in the certainty of grace. Hosea was the last prophet. It's the first in the group of minor prophets, but he was actually the last prophet before Israel's fall. And in his prophecy, Hosea is pleading with the people to turn back to God and to be saved. So he was warning Israel of the judgment to come, but he was also bringing a message of final restoration. So it's a book that's not all doom and gloom. There is certainly doom in it. In fact, there is immediate doom pronounced, but the gloom is dispelled with the promise of eventual hope. Hosea then is often referred to as the prophet of impending doom, but also the prophet of eventual hope. The book of Hosea is the first of the 12 minor prophets in the traditional arrangement of the Old Testament books. The minor prophets are not minor in the sense of being any less important than the major prophets of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. The minor prophets, their messages are just as important. They're referred to as the minor prophets mainly because of the brevity of their writings, although the book of Zechariah isn't altogether that short. But each of the minor prophets, they usually have three main lessons, threefold lessons in each of them. Firstly, there's a historical lesson. Each prophet preached to their own day. They wrote to meet the needs of the people of their own day. So there is a historical lesson. They're speaking to their own people. There's also a prophetical lesson. Each prophet announces or illustrates something about Israel's future, whether that be to do with judgment or to do with a future restoration. So a historical lesson, a prophetical lesson, but also a practical lesson. The sins of the nation in their day, they're the same sins of the nations in our own day. So these messages in the minor prophets have many practical lessons for us to learn for ourselves in our own day. Now, Hosea was one of the four writing prophets who lived in the 8th century BC. The 8th century BC. There were four during that period. Amos and Hosea, who preached in the northern kingdom of Israel, while during at that time Isaiah and Micah were ministering in the southern kingdom of Judah. So Amos and Hosea in the north, at the same time as or around about the same period of Isaiah and Micah being in the south. Amos, Hosea, Isaiah and Micah were living in times when everything seemed to be going so well. There was a period of comparative affluence in both Israel in the north and Judah in the south. But that prosperity, that wealth, wasn't being shared out among all. The rich and the powerful were getting richer and richer and more powerful at the expense of the poor and the vulnerable who are being downtrodden. And so we find that in each of these prophets, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah and Micah, that they address this situation of the state of the condition of the countries at that time or the nations at that time. But they address these situations with their own particular emphasis. Amos focused on the social injustices that were being committed against the people, whereas Hosea stresses how the people are being so unfaithful to God in their idolatry. Now, Hosea was written in the closing part of the 8th century BC. He proclaimed his prophecies to the northern kingdom of Israel in its final years of existence. Hosea was probably the only prophet to the northern kingdom who actually lived in the northern kingdom. Other prophets addressed the northern kingdom, but it was Hosea who actually lived there and ministered there. He lived there throughout his ministry. He addresses the northern kingdom quite often as Ephraim. So whenever you read Ephraim, Ephraim was the dominant tribe in the north. So when he refers to Ephraim, it's like a catch-all term, Ephraim, Israel. They both refer to the northern kingdom. God commissioned Hosea to reveal the widespread apostasy and corruption in the north at that time, while at the same time calling on his fellow countrymen to repent and to turn back to God. So first of all, let's look at the prophet himself. Let's look at Hosea himself, the prophet Hosea. His name means salvation or deliverance. It's the same root word as Joshua and indeed for the name Jesus. Now, just to confuse things, there was a king called Hosea as well, the exact same name, and he's the name of the last king of the northern kingdom. So in order to distinguish between the prophet Hosea and the king Hosea, the last king in the north in Israel, the English Bible spells the name of the prophet as you have it there at the top of your page, H-O-S-E-A, and it spells the name of the king, although his name is exactly the same, it spells the name of the king with an extra H or H, depending on which way you want to pronounce it, the king Hosea. If you look at 2 Kings chapter 17 and verses 1 to 6, it's talking about Hosea, or it's Hosea the king. But you see that they've put in an extra letter there to help you to distinguish and realize this isn't the prophet here. This is referring to the king, the last king of the north in Israel. Very little is actually known about the prophet Hosea, where he came from, or even where his father Beeri was from. It's just not known. However, we do know much more about his own personal circumstances, because his personal situation was of great importance and it was of great significance to the message that he was called to deliver. He's often called the gentlest, the gentlest of the Old Testament prophets, because Hosea was called to one of history's most difficult missions. He was commanded by God to marry Gomer, a prostitute who abandoned him for a series of lovers, and thereby breaking the marriage covenant, that covenant which bound them together as husband and wife. But all the while, Hosea continued to love Gomer, and he remained faithful to Gomer, and he never gave up on Gomer. Hosea's experience was God's own experience with his people, Israel. Even though Israel was bound to God in a covenant relationship, Israel turned away from God to go after idols, to go after other gods. So Gomer was a picture, an exact picture of Israel, of what Israel was like in their relationship with God. And we learn that God never stopped loving Israel any more than Hosea stopped loving Gomer. Indeed, Hosea takes Gomer back after her unfaithfulness. Hosea's situation is a very powerful visual aid of the message that God has, the message that God had for his people. So it's a very unsettling book. It's not a comfortable book. It's a very moving book. We see very starkly Hosea's pain, and that pain is just a mirror. It's just a reflection of God's pain when his beloved is unfaithful. The book of Hosea shows how God's love truly is a love that will not let us go, even when we are unfaithful to him. Gomer bears Hosea three children. Some suggest that perhaps one of them was not Hosea's, but she bears three children, and each one was given a prophetic name. The first one, Jezreel, the name means not shown compassion. Then a daughter called Lo-Ruhamah, her name means no mercy. And then another son, Lo-Ami, meaning not my people, or I am not yours. You are not my people, and I am not your God, says the Lord. And together these three children speak of God's judgment. That's one side of the message of Hosea, God's judgment upon their idolatry and their unfaithfulness. The other side of his message is that judgment is also to be reversed. Chapter 1, reading verses 10 and 11. Yet the number of the people of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head. And then chapter 2, verse 1, say ye unto my brethren, Ami, and to your sisters, Ruhamah. The exact opposite is the reverse. I will have mercy on Lo-Ruhamah. I will have mercy on no mercy. And I will say to Lo-Ami, not my people, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God. So Hosea's family circumstances illustrate Israel's apostasy, and yet at the same time God's steadfast covenant love. There's no record of what becomes of Hosea following this time of ministry that's recorded for us here in his prophecy. So the prophet himself, the prophet Hosea. Secondly, let's just consider the background to the prophecy of Hosea. We actually know more about the age in which Hosea lived than we do about him. Hosea chapter 1 and verse 1 gives us the setting of his prophecy. It's quite an interesting introduction to the, giving us this setting. The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now, these are the kings of Judah. Kings of Judah. Remember where we are? Hosea is in Israel. He's in the north. But we're setting the scene here. And at this time, in Judah, Hosea is about in the days of all of these four kings in the south. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. So he ministers in the north while Jeroboam is king. In the south, he's ministering all the time during the period of these four kings that are mentioned in verse 1. So he begins his prophetic ministry near the end of the kings, near the end of the reigns of the kings. Near the end of the reigns of Israel's king Jeroboam the second in the north, and then these others in the south. And now Israel in the north is Hosea's primary concern. So, and it's strange that the only king is mentioned is Jeroboam, because he was actually around for six Israelite kings, but Jeroboam is the only one that gets a mention. So it's uncertain why these others are left out. Perhaps it's because their reigns were actually quite short and therefore very insignificant, and the most significant one really was Jeroboam the second, and that's why he is mentioned alone. Four out of those six kings were assassinated, and it just gives an indication of the climate of what was going on in Israel at the time. So there were actually six kings around during Hosea's time, but Jeroboam the second is the only one that gets a mention. Now Jeroboam the second, when he comes to power, it's at a time when there's a lot of change going on. When Israel's two main enemies to the north, so above Israel, there's two main threats, Syria and Assyria. But when Jeroboam the second comes to reign, Syria and Assyria are quite weak. There's a lot of trouble going on within their own nation or nations, and a lot of internal conflicts, and they're trying to deal with other situations that are going on as well. So they're preoccupied, and they've taken their eye off Israel. And Jeroboam takes advantage of the situation to extend the borders of Israel. You can read about it in 2 Kings chapter 14. So Jeroboam is having a period of great military success. They're expanding their success on the battlefield. Once again, without this threat from Syria and Assyria, they're free again to engage in trade. So the place is just getting more and more prosperous. They're just more success one after the other. Yet despite all this, despite these victories, despite the success, despite this prosperity, Jeroboam II brings a time of great suffering to the people of Israel, because what happens is that there's two classes develop within the nation. There's the lower class, which are oppressed and downtrodden. They're being kept in poverty, while those with influence and power are just getting richer and richer and more powerful, and they're living in excess. 2 Kings chapter 14 again tells us about the situation, and it tells us in 2 Kings 14 verses 23 to 29 that Jeroboam was actually a very bad king. He was a very bad king in terms of what was going on religiously in the land. It was a time of great prosperity, but the nation was actually rotting away inwardly. They were rotten on the inside. Everything looked great on the outside, but it was rotten to the core on the inside, because they were trusting in foreign alliances rather than trusting in God, trusting God to lead them and protect them. And it was rotten to the core, but the people were still religious. The problem with the religion in the north was that right from the very start, when the kingdom split in two between Rehoboam, Solomon's son, was reigning. Under Rehoboam, the kingdom splits into the north and the south. Rehoboam is in the south. Jeroboam is in the north. Jeroboam doesn't want the people from the north heading back down to Jerusalem to worship, so he sets up sanctuaries in Bethel and Dan to try and keep the people up there in the north. And so he sets up a counterfeit system of worship. This is actually Jeroboam the first. 1 Kings 12 tells us about him. He sets up his own altars, he sets up his own priesthood, and it's all in total disregard of God's law. So they've set up a counterfeit system of worship. So even though they were being religious at this point in Hosea's day, it was a false religion. It was totally contrary to God's instructions. And we find that, as Hosea mentions again and again, that they're actually worshipping pagan gods, false deities, Canaanite deities in villages throughout Israel. Hosea reflects on this again and again, this religious situation, throughout his prophecies. The problem actually goes right the way back, even before Rehoboam, before Solomon, before David. It goes back. The problem started when the Israelites first came into the Promised Land. When they entered into the land of Canaan under Joshua, they came in, they were to conquer the land, they were to take over, they were to get rid of all this paganism, these Canaanites, but they failed to destroy the people that had settled there. And those people, those Canaanites, and their descendants, and their religion continued on. They didn't completely eradicate them, and they just carried on with them just beside them, with their worship going on. The Canaanites worshipped many gods, chief of which was Baal. Baal was supposed to be the god who gave fertility to the land. The Canaanite religion was designed, it was all about fertility for the land. It didn't have a place for any high value of morals whatsoever. And Israel was supposed to worship one God, the one true God, the Lord. The Lord couldn't be manipulated. His arm couldn't be twisted by rituals. The Lord required strict obedience instead. And what was happening was that Israel was trying to mix the two, to follow the Lord, but also to keep on side of Baal, to ensure the fertility of the land. So they were trying to mix these two together. The kingdom of Israel might have seemed to be very prosperous on the outside, but it was actually at a very low spiritual point here during Hosea's ministry. In fact, in Hosea chapter 4, verses 6 and 9, and chapter 6, verse 9, we read that the priests were the ones who were actually leading the people into sin. There was idolatry, and involved in this false worship, and the seeking to have fertility for the land. It involved temple prostitution. It was rampant. Hosea chapter 4, verses 11 to 14. Hosea 7, verses 3 to 5, tells us that it was nothing strange for the kings to be drunk and to be committing adultery. That situation was about to completely change, as prophesied by Hosea, as foreseen by Hosea. The Assyrians are going to be on the rise once again. things get sorted out up in the north, and the Assyrians revive their interest in expanding once again into the areas around them. And in 733-732 BC, the northern kingdom, Israel, was made a puppet state of within the Assyrian empire. Assyria, once again, takes control of Israel. 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 29. Israel decides to plot a revolt to try and turn things around back in their favor again. But Assyria isn't going to have any of that, and Israel is defeated in 722 BC by the Assyrians, and the people, the Israelites, are deported. 2 Kings chapter 17 and 2 Kings 18 tell us about that. Also at the same time in the south, although the Assyrians don't completely conquer Judah at this point, Judah in the south is also incorporated as a vassal state within the Assyrian Empire during Hosea's time. So we have the prophet, a bit of the background of what's going on under Jeroboam the second and those few kings after him before the fall. Thirdly then, the message of the book of Hosea. The book of Hosea can really be summarized in its last verse, the very last verse, Hosea 14 and verse 9. Who is wise, and he shall understand these things, prudent, and he shall know them, for the ways of the Lord are right, and the just shall walk in them, but the transgressors shall fall therein. The ways of the Lord are right and upright, walk in them, but transgressors, they shall fall, they shall stumble in them. The wise will live godly lives. The foolish, the ungodly, will live ungodly lives. The godly will have restoration. They will have victory, as promised in Hosea 13, verse 14. They will have blessing, chapter 14, and verses 4 to 7. Idolatry is essentially anything that takes the sole place of God in the human heart. And the problem here in Hosea's day is that Israel has substituted heathen deities in the place of God. They are given over to national pride. The religious ceremony is practiced, but God is nowhere in it. They're forming political alliances for their own protection, for their own well-being, instead of trusting in God. They're involved in building projects that Hosea speaks about in Hosea 8 and verse 14. They are affluent, but it's selfish. There's greed. They're downtrodding the poor. And then again and again he speaks of the idolatry. And it's all in place of God, in place of God's instruction, in place of God's help, in place of God's blessing, in place of God's salvation. But it was only in God that they could find true blessing and security. Hosea's prophecy shows us how serious sin is and the terrible consequences of continuing in sin, the terrible nature of God's judgment that comes against it. But at the same time, as well as the pronouncement of judgment, there's also the emphasis on the mercy and the love of God. It appears again and again throughout his prophecy. So as I said at the beginning, he's the prophet of impending doom, but he's also the prophet of eventual hope. Hosea presents apostasy, this corruption as being something that's infectious. It might begin at the top, it might begin with the spiritual leaders, it might begin with the people, but it just spreads one to another. Hosea 4 and verse 9. So the prophet, the background and the message. And then finally, the purpose of the book of Hosea. The main purpose of Hosea's prophecy, just like the others in his century, in the 8th century BC, his contemporaries Amos, Isaiah and Micah in the south, his prophecy needs to be understood against the background of the message and the theology of the book of Deuteronomy, because Deuteronomy records for us the covenant agreement between God and Israel. This is at the heart of it. This is at the root of the matter. Israel was to be loyal to the Lord alone, to worship him alone. They were to obey his commandments, to keep his instructions. Obedience to the covenant would result in blessing. Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 to 14. Disobedience, disobeying the covenant, breaking the covenant, would bring judgment and eventually exile. And exile is in there. It's part of the curse for breaking the covenant. Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 to 68. And Hosea's role as a prophet was to expose how the nation had broken this covenant and to announce God's intention to implement the covenant curses that are recorded in Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 to 68. At the same time, however, Hosea affirms the promise in Deuteronomy of Israel's ultimate restoration, Deuteronomy 30 and verses 1 to 10. So the book of Hosea was designed to convince the Israelites that they needed to repent. They've broken God's covenant. They need to come back. They need to come back to him, to their long-suffering God, so that judgment might be turned away from them. They needed to know that God loved them in spite of their unfaithfulness. And all of this is all the while being demonstrated in Hosea's own family situation, in his relationship with Gomer. Israel needed to know that their problems, all of the difficulties that they were encountering when Assyria comes down as a threat once again, that their problems were being caused because of their spiritual adultery, because of their disobedience. The pain of discipline through military defeat was all part of the curse mentioned in Deuteronomy for breaking the covenant. But they also needed to know that the pain of judgment, the pain of discipline, was just a step along the way that God was using in his efforts not to destroy them, not to tear them down, but actually to get his people to respond to his love for them and to turn them back. God was the faithful and loving husband. His people stood condemned as being unfaithful. They needed to know that this combination of God's discipline and love was his call on them to return back to him. The book of Hosea reveals to the people of Israel the goal and the motivation behind God's judgments and punishment. Hosea was answering questions like, why are we being punished? Why are these things happening to us? And Hosea is saying to them, it's because you've broken the covenant relationship with God. Does God hate us? Does God hate his chosen people now? What's happening? And Hosea says, no, he's punishing you. He doesn't hate you. He is punishing you because he loves you. He wants to win you back. Have God's people lost the promises of God that were made to them? No. He's punishing them to bring them back to repentance, to restore them at a future point. Something that God's people still continue to struggle with as we live in a sin-cursed world. Believers struggle with our own tendencies to disobey God. And just like Israel, Christians might experience at times God's painful discipline. And during such times, we need to hear Hosea's message that God's love should motivate us to stay faithful to him, to stay close to him. It was the believers, it wasn't God, who had broke the bond of faithfulness to such an extent that only the pain of discipline was sufficient to bring them back. The pain is designed not to to turn them away, not to cast them off, not to make them run away from God, but rather it's designed really to bring them back, to turn them back to him. Well then, there are 14 chapters in the book of Hosea. I looked it up on YouTube, somebody reading Hosea. It takes 30 minutes. 30 minutes to read 14 chapters. Chapters 1 to 3, basically some biography about Hosea and Gomer. Chapters 4 to 14, but actually in chapters 1 to 3 as well, we have a series of cycles of these judgments and the hope of restoration. So judgment and hope, especially 4 to 14. And remember the invitation and the promise at the very end in chapter 14 and verse 9. Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the upright walk in them, but transgressors stumble in them. Well, hopefully, this introduction will give us a bit more background and hopefully a bit more information to go on as we sit down and read Hosea in 30 minutes. Very quick, but such valuable lessons it has for us today. Remember, it's a book that will comfort the afflicted, but it also afflicts the comfortable. Sometimes we might need a bit of affliction to awaken us out of our sloth and out of being in our comfort zone. It gives us a very startling presentation of sin and how the people of God can go off and do their own thing and go their own way. But it reassures us again and again of the certainty of God's grace, the certainty of God's love, the certainty of God's mercy, if we'd only turn back to him, as we sang earlier in Psalm 81. Let's close as we sing from Psalm 89. Psalm 89, and we'll sing verses 29 to 34. Psalm 89. Again, it talks about God's judgments and his discipline of those that wander from his ways, but it also talks about his covenant love and his love for his people. So verses 29 to 34, and the tune is Aaron number 60. Let's stand and worship God.